From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, the rise of Islamic fundamentalism. Why now? We'll talk with Islamic scholar Abdulaziz Sachedina. Also today, we talk with Gerald Early about the dilemmas of being an African-American middle-class intellectual. Early heads the African American Studies Department at Washington University, and he's edited a new collection of essays on the ambivalence of assimilation. And on this St. Patrick's Day, Maureen Corrigan reviews the new literary Irish cookbook, A Trifle, A Coddle, A Fry. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. The news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Dale Willman. At least six people were killed today when an Amtrak train hit a gasoline tanker truck at a railroad crossing in Florida. Officials say the collision caused an explosion which destroyed nine vehicles. The train was carrying 108 passengers at the time of the accident. Only slight injuries were reported by train passengers. A federal grand jury in Manhattan has handed up indictments against two suspects in last month's World Trade Center bombing. From member station WNYC, Dick Hinchcliffe reports.
The single-paragraph indictment accuses Mohammed Salama and Nidal Ayad, both 25, of willfully and maliciously damaging the Twin Towers by using an explosive device causing the death of six persons. More than 1,000 people were injured in the blast. A third indictment was issued against Ibrahim El-Jabrouni for obstruction of justice and fraud. The fraud charge is the only new criminal count issued by the grand jury. Authorities searching El-Jabrouni's Brooklyn apartment found five fake passports in the name of El-Said Nosseir. He's the man cleared of murdering radical rabbi Meir Kahana. All three suspects remain in jail without bail. The FBI's New York director, James Fox, says the agency has no evidence of other suspects fleeing the country. Published reports say three other men believed to be directly involved used phony passports to fly out of Kennedy Airport within 48 hours of the bombing. For National Public Radio, I'm Dick Hinchcliffe in New York.
President Clinton met with Irish Prime Minister Albert Reynolds at the White House today. The two agreed that the best framework for a solution to the turmoil in Northern Ireland is to resume talks between the British and Irish governments. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports.
At a joint news conference following the meeting, President Clinton announced that Jean Kennedy Smith, sister of Senator Edward Kennedy, has been nominated to be the ambassador to Ireland. The Irish Prime Minister presented President Clinton with a bowl of shamrock, saying that he appreciates the administration's keen interest in resuming talks aimed at ending the violence in Northern Ireland. The two leaders said they discussed whether the U.S. should send a special envoy to the troubled province. Referring to British objections, President Clinton said today he doesn't want to do anything to undermine the peace process.
I do believe that the dialogue that was opened not all that long ago between these two governments in Ireland and Great Britain offer the real chance of producing a framework within which peace could occur.
Prime Minister Reynolds had this parting message.
Banachtí na féile páirc, I hope Americans of all ethnic backgrounds have a wonderful St. Patrick's Day.
I'm Elizabeth Arnold at the White House.
The Federal Reserve Board said today that factories ran at their busiest rate in almost 1.5 years in February, as the nation's industrial output posted a fifth straight monthly rise. The Fed said industrial output was up 0.4% last month, continuing a string of gains that began in October. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials closed lower today, losing almost 16 points, closing at 3427.01. This is NPR News. The State Department says U.S. and North Korean diplomats met in China today over North Korea's refusal to allow further inspections of its nuclear facilities. Spokesman Richard Boucher says the U.S. and other members of the international community, including the United Nations Security Council, are concerned about the North Korean decision. U.S. intelligence agencies believe North Korea's nuclear program is intended to produce nuclear weapons. North Korea has denied that, but previous U.N. inspections have found evidence the country possesses more weapons-grade plutonium than it has claimed. Russian President Boris Yeltsin has appealed for stronger military and economic ties among the Commonwealth of Independent States. He says it's the only way for Russia to get through its political and economic crisis. NPR's Kathleen Hunt has more from Moscow.
Yeltsin Yeltsin's call for a stronger Commonwealth was summarized by his foreign minister, Andrei Kozarev, today, while the president himself held meetings with his National Security Council to discuss how to regain some of the authority he lost at the hands of the conservative Congress last week. The Congress, which is dominated by anti-reform communists and nationalists, vetoed Yeltsin's proposal to hold a referendum on whether Russia should have a strong presidential system, and it stripped him of many of his powers. This was Yeltsin's boldest appeal to tighten cooperation among the former republics to date and stress the need for unified military efforts to control the outbreaks of regional and ethnic conflict. Meanwhile, communists and other Yeltsin opponents planned a rally in Moscow to mark the second anniversary of the referendum in which Soviet voters elected to preserve the Soviet Union. This is Kathleen Hunt in Moscow.
Defense Secretary Les Aspin undergoes surgery tomorrow to receive a pacemaker. Doctors say Aspin will receive the device during a two-hour procedure conducted under a local anesthetic. Aspin has a heart problem that's led to a shortness of breath. He's currently in the Georgetown University Hospital in Washington, D.C. It's the second time in 3 weeks he's been hospitalized because of his heart. This is National Public Radio News from Washington. I'm Dale Willman.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. What is Islamic fundamentalism, and why are militant Islamic groups on the rise? My guest, Abdulaziz Sashidina, is an Islamic scholar who's been researching Islamic fundamentalism and conflicting Western and Islamic perspectives on human rights and religious liberty. We called him earlier today to talk about Islamic fundamentalists in the Middle East and in the United States. American law enforcement officials say that suspects in the World Trade Center bombing are connected with militant Islamic fundamentalist groups. Sashidina is a visiting professor of Islamic studies at McGill University in Montreal. He's also a professor at the University of Virginia. He grew up in Tanzania and studied in India, Iran, and Canada. I asked him why he's been studying Islamic fundamentalism.
I am more concerned to find out what exactly are Muslims searching for in the 1980s and 90s, because we had a sort of a reform movement in Islamic world, which we read about and which we know academically, that 19th and early part of 20th century, there was a lot of intellectual rethinking in the religious realm. All of a sudden, in after 70s, we find that once again, Islamic discourse is coming to the forefront. People are talking about Islam. People are talking about implementing Islamic law. Why now? Why? What is it that really prompts it at this time to respond the way they are responding? So that has been my main interest in finding out the reason that why at this time, after we thought that we had already found solutions, we had already talked about so many things in the realm of reform, in changing our ways, in introducing technicalization in our societies, why now are we talking about something that is... It seems to be almost going backwards rather than forwards.
Now, when we talk about Christian fundamentalism, one of the things that's usually referred to within that is a literal reading of the Bible. Is there a similar phenomenon in Islamic fundamentalism, a literal reading of the Quran?
No, there isn't anything of that sort, because there has always been a sort of interpretive approach to the scripture in Islam. So even when it was revealed for the first time, we do know for sure that the early Muslims read it and interpreted it and did not take it literally. But there is another form of literalism, is implementation of the past decisions. So it is not the scripture as much as the norms that are being implemented to the very literal sense of those norms. And that's where we do have some sort of comparison between the Christian fundamentalists, who are literally interpreting the Bible, whereas the Muslim fundamentalists would literally interpret, or would literally go back to the norms that were formulated, let's say, in 9th century or 10th century, almost 300 years after Islam emerged as a world religion. So there is that kind of going back and retrieving materials literally from that period.
The fundamentalists who are returning to earlier centuries' interpretations of the Quran, did you see that as a reaction against modernization?
A reaction against unsatisfactory modernization. One of the reasons why Islamic fundamentalism is really catching up is the social and political conditions that are prevalent in the Islamic world. We do read about it. There is a level of poverty about which the governments have not done much. There is social injustice. There is political injustice that is prevalent in most of the Muslim societies. So you do find that that is the thrust of the reaction.
I think it's fair to say that yes. Islamic fundamentalism has an intolerance of pluralism, whether it's other religions or secularism. Do you find justification for that in the Quran?
Not in the Quran, but certainly in the behavior and the conduct of the Muslim fundamentalists, one does see intolerance, not only towards, I would say, the pluralism or plurality of other religions, but even within the Islamic community, you do find them to be intolerant of differences of opinion within the community. So they do go, I would characterize their understanding of Islam as, my Islam is the Islam that should be believed and should be followed.
You've described Islamic fundamentalism as a return to earlier centuries' interpretations of the Quran. Is there a contemporary Islam that tries to apply the teachings of the Quran to the modern world as we know it, without returning to the interpretations of earlier centuries?
Muslim fundamentalists have not still, in my opinion, created intellectual structures which would help them to retrieve that information and make it relevant today. That's the big problem that they face. It's an intellectual problem because they are not intellectually oriented, by the way. Many Muslim fundamentalist leaders are traditionalists in their education, and they do not really, they are not, I would say, trained in independence of thought, independence of mind, and critical evaluation of the past to the point of creating new sort of discourse that would be more relevant to the modern society, to the modern situation.
Is there a group of Islamic scholars or Islamic intellectuals who are interpreting Islam for the modern world without looking backwards?
There are quite a few, but they do not have the credibility in the eyes of the Muslims, nor in the eyes of the traditional scholars. So the establishment does not look at them as the authentic representatives of the tradition. So you have a problem that there are Muslim intellectuals who would like to go independent of the past tradition and go to the Quran, perhaps to the original text, and create a new interpreted version of Islam for the modern days. They suffer from what I call lack of credibility for the Muslims in general.
Where do you see yourself fitting in now as an Islamic scholar and somebody who is a person of the faith?
I'm afraid to say that although I work very closely with the Muslim community, especially in North American context, or in the Western context in general, I find that many times my work is obstructed by the traditional outlook that is prevalent in the Muslim communities that that still look towards the mother countries for the Islamic leadership, which is actually not delivering what it is looking for. So I might have a sort of influence on the younger Muslim generation who are growing up in this part of the world, who are part of this, I would say, North American social universe. But I do not have the same kind of influence with the older generation that still is bicultural and still looks upon the traditional world of Islam as the source of its religious values. So our work is, I face a lot of challenges, there's no doubt, and I face a lot of problems. But we are making, so to speak, success. We have some success with the Muslim community in the West, but I don't think we are taken very seriously in the Islamic world.
My guest is Abdulaziz Sashadina. He's a professor of Islamic studies at the University of Virginia, visiting professor of Islamic studies at McGill University this semester. We're going to take a short break. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Islamic scholar Abdulaziz Sashidina.
What was your reaction when you found out that some of the suspects in the bombing of the World Trade Center towers are believed to have ties to Islamic fundamentalist groups?
My reaction was a mixed one, because unless and until it is established that these are really the ones who are connected to, because there is, if they are connected to, I mean to say that the Muslim organizations or Muslim fundamentalists, it's rather premature for us on this, perhaps without proper evidence, to level them all as Muslim terrorists who are supported by the Islamic fundamentalists. So I find it rather difficult to do that. My reaction was immediately to say that it could very well be some of these individuals who have taken upon themselves to do these things, but it would be difficult to find support by any reasonable, I'm emphasizing on this term, reasonable and rational Islamic groups in the Islamic world, because there are two kinds of Islamic fundamentalists in the Islamic world. There are those who believe in the radical activism, and there are those who believe in negotiated and in a more careful and more civilized way of dealing with the question of establishing justice. And I think that if one were to connect them with those groups that are really seeking to redress the wrongs by taking these actions, then I think there would be very little support among the Muslims themselves. And in fact, I can say that majority of the Muslims would disagree with what they are doing and the way they are doing it. There's a lot of self-criticism within the Muslim groups themselves about the way they are going about doing these things. So you have a problem of what I call a kind of, there is no united leadership. This is very interesting to note, that in the Muslim fundamentalist groups, there is no united leadership. They do not recognize one united leader whose word will be taken as the final word. And therefore, it really remains to be established who is exactly behind this particular group to which this Salama is perhaps loyal to or obeying the orders of, commands of. We really need to find out who exactly is this group.
A couple of suspects in the World Trade Center tower bombings are said to have ties to Sheikh Omar Abdel Rahman, an Egyptian cleric who stood trial and was acquitted in Egypt on charges of assassinating Anwar Sadat. And he now has a mosque in Jersey City.
That's right.
And he's said to be the spiritual leader of several extremist groups. What do you know about him?
I have appeared with him in a certain in a context of the Muslim student organization having a forum every December. Some years ago, I met him and I saw him. And he is a fiery speaker, there's no doubt about it. But I think he is being indicted unnecessarily in this particular situation, because his position, by the way, is very normal position in the Muslim culture of a religious leader. I get calls from Geneva, I get calls from Paris, I get calls from London asking me questions of moral content. What should be our reaction to the government that we know is oppressing us regarding paying our taxes to that government? Should we evade taxes? Because, you know, that is morally wrong to do it. Legal aside, you have also moral questions, the question of conscience. And we get this question, and sometimes we don't have a proper answer for it. And I'm sure Omar Abdel Rahman is one of those leaders whose presence in North American context makes it almost imperative for many Muslims around in the country to ask him questions about these events, about what should be their response. And here you are drawn into a topic that is not your area of speciality per se. For example, political Islam, which is the true nature of Islamic fundamentalism. And a group like Muhammad Salama would come, a person like Muhammad Salama would come and would ask questions about, well, I am a Palestinian, I am being wronged in my country, I have no home, I have no this. What should be my reaction to this world? And Omar Abdel Rahman would cite certain traditions of the Prophet that you cannot bear injustices, you have to stand firm against injustices, and you should demand your rights, and you should be very firm about it. Now, all these things could be construed by us to be extremist response to the given situation. I think that he's being drawn into something without proper justification, I think.
I've read, and I mean, I've only read this. I don't know how true it is. I have no firsthand knowledge of this. Uh-huh. But I've read that his messages include calls to eradicate anyone who stands in the way of Islam.
Which will be, by the way, you will hear this commonly among the religious leaders. I have heard in Jordan, when I was during the Gulf crisis, I was in Jordan in the Friday sermon, the khatib, the man who gives the sermon, would call upon people in a very similar tone. And it is the call for jihad, for example, is such a common theme in the Islamic world that many a times you hear it, and it is taken in a very different context. It is part of what I call the Islamic ideology, where you have to struggle to establish justice. And we take jihad in a very limited sense of holy war, and which is, by the way, one of the meanings of jihad is holy war. One of the meanings of jihad is to fight in the path of God. But it has also the meaning of struggling for justice to be established. And this, in the context of Jordan, if you remember this, King Hussein would be very, very much upset, if you will, really, to hear a call to overthrow him. But that's not the message. The message is that Muslims ought to be struggling for establishing justice, both at personal level, at the social level, which is a very common theme in the Islamic world.
Do you think that there needs to be people within the Islamic world who stand up and disavow these actions?
Certainly. You're absolutely right. This is where I think even the Muslim leaders are failing, that they have to really come out in open, say that we are not supporters of these things, and we are not part of this at all. I think there has to be disclaimers from the Islamic world itself. And I'm sure there has been, which are not usually reported, as we know that we don't report everything that comes out of the Islamic world.
And I know as part of your studies of Islamic fundamentalism, you've been to the Middle East fairly recently.
Yes.
When were you there? Where did you go?
I have been to Jordan recently, to Saudi Arabia in December, to Pakistan in December, also to Iran in October. So I've been to many parts, different parts, in the last 12 months.
Can you tell me what you look for when you go?
All depends what I'm searching for. Many a times I'm searching for finding out if there have been any new solutions to the pressing problems of what I call Islamic modernism, Islamic reforms, Islamic epistemology. Anything new has been done, any new thinking has come forward, any new intellectuals have come forward, any women who have found a voice in the Muslim societies to raise their concerns, to discuss, to sit in dialogue about their situation. These are the things that I search for.
Have you found new thinking emerging or new women's voices emerging?
It depends. In other parts, in Jordan, it was easier to hear those voices. In Saudi Arabia, it is impossible to hear that voice because you don't have a contact. Even my wife, being with me and being able to talk to the people whenever she went to the mosque or anything, was not able to gather much information. In Pakistan, you do hear voices that are new voices. There are voices that were never heard before. But on the whole, in my own assessment, I'm not, although I'm optimistic, I'm known by my colleagues to be very optimistic, I'm not terribly optimistic at this time, seeing the situation the way it is being handled by the religious leadership in the Islamic world in general.
What would you like to see the Islamic leadership do?
To make Islamic norms relevant to the modern times. I think Islam has a lot to offer. Islam has a lot to contribute, and therefore I believe in the Muslims in this part of the world, even in North America, through their integration, have a lot to offer to the Western world and have to make their voices heard positively and not the way it is being heard through these terroristic actions, unfortunately. And there I think that Islamic leadership has to take an action in creating what I call the strategies of interaction, intellectual interaction with the West, with the whole world, rather than remaining in their own small world of what I call traditional Islamic ways of thinking.
And what do you see your own role within that as being?
I think I see myself as a bridge between the two, because I was educated both in the Islamic world, in the same institutions in which the Muslim leadership was educated, in the seminaries. And also I was educated in the universities in the West. So I combine in me both the approaches and the wealth of the information that is brought from the seminaries and the methodology that is learned in the scientific and the free thinking institutions, universities in the West. So I combine both. So I see myself as a bridge. And many a times I'm invited in the Islamic world to share my ways of my methodology, my ways of solving the problems that are pressing problems for the Muslim communities, especially problems of integration with the social universe, wherever they happen to be.
Can you share with us some advice that you've given on that subject?
I usually tell them to look at rather the situation as a human situation. I always search for human norms. And I think that Islam, the Quran itself, talks about these human norms. The Quran sees the human unity. It sees different religions as particular paths leading to those norms that Quran believes are present in all human beings. And my message is always to search for those common norms which can become the source for the human dialogue, for common concerns, for common moral concerns, for common human concerns that can be shared all around the world. And the problems today are global problems. When we talk about democracy, we are not talking about democracy only in one part of the world. When we talk about social justice, we are not talking about social justice only in one part of the world. We are talking about global social justice. We are talking about global democratic situation. And therefore, I think that when I talk to my fellow Muslims, especially Muslim leaders, I'm always urging them to say that, to talk in terms of human norms. I don't want them to reject West as being Western. I tell them that West has human norms to offer. There are international norms that we can talk about and we can agree upon and we can implement them in the tools to improve the human situation all around the world.
Abdulaziz Sashadina is a professor of Islamic studies at McGill University and the University of Virginia. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, race, identity, and the ambivalence of assimilation. We talk with Gerald Early, who edited a new book of essays on the subject. Early directs the African American Studies Department at Washington University. He's faced many dilemmas as an African American intellectual. And Maureen Corrigan reviews a new Irish cookbook of meals referred to in the works of famous Irish writers. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. On Capitol Hill, the Senate has approved the so-called Motor Voter Bill, which supporters say will increase voter registration around the country. NPR's Richard Gonzalez reports.
The vote ends a contentious debate over whether states should be required to register potential voters at motor vehicle registration offices and welfare and unemployment offices. Republicans argued that such a law would benefit the Democrats because welfare applicants would be exposed to potential coercion by registrars. The GOP used several tactics to delay a vote, including a filibuster the Democrats were unable to end yesterday. But today a compromise was reached after Democrats agreed to Republican demands for limiting the kinds of public agencies where states would have to require registration. Under the agreement, states would be permitted to register voters at welfare and unemployment offices, but not required to. Registration would still be required at motor vehicle, disability, and military recruiting offices. The bill now goes to conference committee, and President Clinton has said he will sign the motor voter bill. I'm Richard Gonzalez in Washington.
Secretary of Defense Les Aspin will have a heart pacemaker implanted tomorrow morning. Doctors say the implant is aimed at correcting a problem that has led to shortness of breath. For the second time in 2 weeks, Aspin has been hospitalized in Washington, complaining of shortness of breath and a possible bronchial condition. However, doctors say these symptoms are caused by an underlying heart problem. Surgery tomorrow will last for 2 hours, and Aspin is expected back on the job sometime next week. Military officials in Germany say that German planes will start taking part in the U.S. airdrop of food and medicine to eastern Bosnia next week. Deidre Berger reports from Frankfurt.
Three German Transall planes will start flying missions to eastern Bosnia next week, according to the German Defense Ministry. U.S. planes have dropped hundreds of parcels of food and medical supplies over cities in eastern Bosnia cut off from outside help by Serbian forces since the airdrop began more than 2 weeks ago. The German planes, like the U.S. planes, will also depart from Rhein-Main Air Force Base in Frankfurt. German defense officials initially expressed skepticism the Transall planes were suitable for high-altitude airdrops, but several dozen members of the German Air Force have been practicing simulated drops since last week, prompting the go-ahead. Russia has also said it will send 2 planes to join the airlift, but there's not yet been final word on the starting date. For National Public Radio, this is Deidre Bergen, Frankfurt.
Searchers have found another body in the burned-out rubble of a residential hotel in Chicago. At least 16 people died in yesterday's early morning fire, the deadliest in Chicago in 12 years. Officials say the fire may have been caused by damaged extension cords used for a space heater. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down 16 points in very heavy trading. This is NPR News. Police in Calcutta have arrested 2 suspects in connection with yesterday's huge explosion that killed at least 60 people and destroyed 2 downtown buildings. The army was put on alert after the arrest that reportedly involved 2 Muslims. Rioting involving Hindus and Muslims last year killed nearly 2,000 people. Police say investigators are trying to determine if the explosion might have occurred accidentally and involved explosives stored in the building. The chairman of the Senate Finance Committee is rejecting possible health care price controls, which reportedly may be part of the Clinton health care reform package. New York Senator Daniel Patrick Moynihan says the idea would lead to disaster. Michael Carice of member station WAMC reports.
Moynihan was reacting to a report in today's Washington Post that White House advisors have told health care and insurance industry representatives that short-term price controls will be needed. Speaking on a statewide call-in program in New York Wednesday afternoon, Moynihan said if the Clinton task force is planning to implement price controls in a detailed, specific form, they're heading for disaster.
It won't pass the Congress. And if by some means it did pass the Congress, it wouldn't work in reality. Price controls just distort the economy. What we need is incentives to get the outcomes we want, not federal regulation.
Parts of President Clinton's economic plan, including health care reform, will have to go through the Finance Committee. For National Public Radio, I'm Michael Carice in Albany, New York.
In France, fishermen have clashed again with police during protest over imports. There have been angry demonstrations for more than 1 month now, as demonstrators charge that cheaper imports from Eastern Europe and Russia are destroying their way of life. Protesters want the European Commission to impose limits on certain fish imports. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Race, identity, and the ambivalence of assimilation is the subject of a new collection of essays called Lure and Loathing. The editor is my guest, Gerald Early. He directs the African American Studies Department at Washington University in St. Louis. Early is ambivalent about his own assimilation. He grew up in a working-class neighborhood in Philadelphia. He recently moved to a predominantly white suburb of St. Louis with his wife and two daughters. The move has enabled his children to attend good public schools, but it's removed him from the black community. He's even ambivalent about his success as an African-American intellectual, because that, too, has removed him from the black community.
I think in particular, in my case, as an intellectual, it's very difficult to stay rooted or in the black community in many respects if you're an intellectual, because the structure in the country that supports intellectuals are largely foundations, universities, and so forth. They're mostly white,
mm-hmm.
and you're pulled out of the community if you want to live as an intellectual. And to live as an intellectual and to do what you do in dealing with discourse of ideas is as, I don't want to call it pampered, but in some ways as sheltered a life as being an athlete, a professional athlete. And it also requires a lot of monetary support. It takes a lot of money to support an intellectual full-time and just dealing with ideas. And most of that, most of the money, most of the rewards, most of the perks are found in the white world. And so that's where you naturally gravitate to, because that's where all the rewards and perks are. So I think you feel a kind of a double tension as some kind of intellectual, that you really have been pulled away and you really have been lured away by the rewards that are there for you in the white world.
Well, I guess even locating to be at a university, it can pull you into a university that is predominantly white.
Mm-hmm.
I guess it's different in a way from, say, the show business world, where there seems to be a kind of really growing number of African Americans who are successful in music and movies and television.
Right. There's a number of black Americans in the academic world.
They're divided, though. They're kind of spread out around the country.
Yeah, you're spread out. You know, you get together at conferences.
Uh-huh.
Gossip, which is what everybody else does when you go to a conference. You are spread out. Most of the time at the university where you are, there are only a couple. I mean, you know, they're not very many. You're a very small community. So, I mean, you're spending a good deal of your time interacting with whites. It becomes a very complicated problem. I mean, it's a problem with your work insofar as a very kind of mundane question that people thought, oh, well, this question can't possibly be relevant, but it still is. Who's your work for? I mean, is your work for whites or is your work for blacks? I mean, obviously, because I want a certain kind of standing where I work, I want a certain kind of standing in my profession, I want a certain kind of standing among my colleagues. I mean, in some ways, my work is written for them. I mean, it's written to be read by them, and it's written to be read by them in a way that they understand that I understand the discourse, I understand certain kinds of intellectual issues, that I am a part of their world. In as much as it's pitched toward them in that regard is how, in some ways, it's not being pitched toward ordinary black people. because I'm not dealing day to day with ordinary black people, and my colleagues are not ordinary black people, and the esteem that I get is not whether ordinary black people like my work, it's whether the white intellectuals I'm around like my work, and this causes another kind of identity crisis insofar as who you are and why are you doing what you're doing.
The issue of identity is in some of your essays. Mm-hmm. And in your new book, you write about your daughters growing up in the suburbs. And you say that they would bring home their friends, and their friends would usually be white. And it started to worry you a little bit. You started worrying about the price that they might pay later on for a white social life. What's the price that you thought they might pay?
Well, I thought they might be ostracized by other black kids. In some ways, they are, even now. They come home and tell me, yeah, the other black kids think we talk white, and we act white, and they're confused by that. They don't understand why the other black kids say that. And they don't understand it because their father is this famous professor of black studies. So why are they going around saying, your kids act white, you know? So they're kind of confused by that. But I was very afraid that they would be ostracized that in some of the ways that they're being ostracized now. And that they would kind of lose track, but even more important than that, and that was a secondary concern, but they would kind of lose track of or not fully understand what I'm about insofar as dealing with African-American studies because it's something that doesn't mean anything to them. So they find what I do kind of, you know, being an African-American studies kind of arcane in a way. I mean, it's, yeah, well, that's what my dad does. So it kind of worries me that they are very distanced from what I do.
My guest is Gerald Early. He directs the African American Studies Department at Washington University in St. Louis. More after this break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Gerald Early. He's edited a new collection of essays on race and identity called Lure and Loathing. Now, let me talk to you a little bit about your coming of age. You write that you grew up, you grew up in the 50s and 60s in Philadelphia, and you say you grew up in a family of black women. I believe your father died when you were 1 year old.
Yeah, that's correct.
So who lived in your house?
Well, I had two sisters and my mother, and a parade of, for a time, my great aunt lived with me in our house for a couple years. The biggest influences, not only just living in this household of women, were my mother's sisters. And they were a much more dominant presence in my life than my mother's brothers. So I felt pretty much almost exclusively surrounded by women.
What impact did that have on you as a man or as a boy?
Well,
male.
I think it's interesting. I'm still trying to assess that. I think that's one of the reasons why I'm drawn to writing about my daughters, because I now find myself still in the house of women with my wife and my daughters. I'm still trying to assess that. I think in some ways, I think when I was younger, certainly when I was in my late teens and early 20s, I think I had a great resentment for it. I really felt in some ways I had been denied a certain kind of essential masculine knowledge that I needed to get on in this world. And I think that was one of the reasons why I was attracted to jazz and I was attracted to boxing, was because they were masculine worlds. I really for a certain stage in my life, I was almost obsessed with them because they were masculine. I'm a little bit more balanced now in that regard, but I think that my reaching out to those particular spheres of creative activity in large measure had to do with the fact that they were areas dominated by men.
You say that your mother was driven by ought to and consumed by must. Did she instill in you a sense of discipline and, yeah, and responsibility?
Yeah, incredible work ethic. I mean, my mother probably would have made a very good Calvinist, I think. It was incredible work ethic. And, you know, it's carried, it's carried over. It has its good points and its bad points.
What are they?
Well, insofar as the good points go, I would say that I've turned out to be, so far, a pretty prolific academic, so far as putting out books. I like the work. I like the work, and I like to work. And I like putting out books. I like writing, and I'm a pretty prolific writer. I think the bad thing is that I can be, I think it makes you obsessive. It makes you at times overly ambitious. Makes you directed in certain ways that you shouldn't be, insofar as seeing what your work is about, seeing what the value of your work is.
You had a cousin who was shot in the head in a gang fight when mm-hmm. he was a teenager. What was the impact on your family when that happened?
It was a pretty big impact. To have somebody murdered in your family, I think, is a pretty big deal.
What year was this?
This was 1973. This is still when the teenage gang problem in Philadelphia was real bad. And my family was pretty, upset by it all. I think they were kind of, they were distraught, distressed, and I think somewhat ashamed to have somebody die in that way. For me, it was the start of my writing career because at that time I was a student at the University of Pennsylvania. And the very first thing I ever wrote for print that was published was an op-ed piece for the Daily Pennsylvanian about my cousin's death and his funeral. And that really started my writing career. I didn't know I was going to be a writer or intend to, but I just felt I had to write about this, and it was so well received, I guess because it was a pretty unusual thing to have in the Daily Pennsylvania, that I wound up writing for the paper.
It was the University of Pennsylvania
mm-hmm.
newspaper. What did you really want to say about your cousin's murder that drove you to write about it?
Oh, that I was afraid it would happen to me, or it could have happened to me, something like that. We were very close in age, about 4.5 years apart. And so I knew all about gangs. I knew all about what that was. And, I think I was kind of amazed by it because I said, wow, that could have happened to me. I think that was what I wanted to get to people. I wanted to write it and to present to people, this is a life. As a kid, he wasn't a great kid, but he wasn't a terrible kid. He was just a kid, and he did kind of boyish and wayward sort of things. You shouldn't die for something like that.
One more question. You really don't like the overuse of the word positive. You say the word positive has become the most brutal cant word in Black American discourse. What don't you like about this use of the word positive?
I don't know what people mean by it. I don't know what's positive. I mean, most of the time, people are talking about something positive. They're talking about something. They're talking about they want something that's banal. They're talking about they want something that's philistine. They're talking about they want something that's the most mediocre, second-rate kind of moralism. And that's not really what creating is all about. That's not really what aspiration is all about. That's not really what, that's not really in the end, although black people a lot of times say that's not really what they want. They want people who are out there taking, who are taking risk. That's what really pushes the group ahead. Not to have a whole bunch of platitudes and bromides thrown at you and, you know, being told, oh, yeah, you can make it and all that sort of stuff. I mean, that's cornball stuff. I mean, when I was in school, they were having people come to the assemblies who were saying that. The kids were snoring on that stuff. They didn't want to hear that junk. They didn't want to hear about, oh, you can make it and all that sort of stuff. It's something else that reaches into the life of people. And it's something else you have to tell people if you want them to live by two rules, the rule of justice and the rule of mercy. And, you know, so that's why, you know, for me, positive is just another one of those terrible Philistine bourgeois inventions.
Gerald Early, thank you a lot for talking with us.
Thank you.
Gerald Early edited the new collection of essays, Lure and Loathing, essays on race, identity, and the ambivalence of assimilation. This is Fresh Air. It's St. Patrick's Day. Noah Adams is with us. Noah, what are you doing on St. Patrick's Day on All Things Considered?
Hi, Terry. We'll talk with a member of an Irish lesbian and gay group. She's come to New York from her home in Cork in Ireland to lend support to those who wanted to march under a lesbian and gay banner in New York's St. Patrick's Day parade today. She was disappointed that did not happen, and she tells us that back home in Ireland, in Cork and Dublin, among other places, homosexual groups did indeed take part in the parades there. Also, we'll meet Dahi Spruill. He's from Derry in Northern Ireland, now living in St. Paul, Minnesota, where he's teaching Celtic studies. He's also a well-known Irish musician, a masterful guitar player, and a collector of the traditional Gaelic songs.
Thanks, Noah. Then and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Today being St. Patrick's Day, commentator Maureen Corrigan says if you're not wearing green, you're sure to be turning green after hearing some of the recipes featured in a new cookbook titled A Trifle, A Coddle, A Fry by Veronica Jane O'Mara and Fionnuala O'Reilly.
I may be biased, but it seems to me that lately it's become very chic to be Irish. Take the arts, for instance. What's the hottest movie around? The Crying Game, an Irish movie. Who's the hunkiest new leading man? Liam Neeson, an Irish actor. Who's the most universally loathed female performer? Not Madonna, not Roseanne, Sinead O'Connor, a loathed Irish female performer. This year, the St. Patrick's Day Parade in New York even made 60 Minutes and the cover of The New Yorker, when the ancient Order of the Hibernians refused to let gay and lesbian Irish Americans march. Maybe somebody should leaflet the Hibernians with copies of The Ballad of Reading Jail, a moving poem by one of the most brilliant Irish writers of all time, Oscar Fingal O'Flaherty Wills Wilde. Wilde published the poem in 1898 after spending years in prison for the crime of homosexuality. It's guaranteed to melt the heart of even the most hidebound Hibernian. Besides sex, the Irish tend to be a wee bit conservative in their attitudes towards another one of life's great pleasures, food. But this year, when all things Irish have become trendy, there have even been some courageous attempts to celebrate Irish haute cuisine. And I don't mean green beer. A charming new cookbook entitled A Trifle, A Coddle, A Fry offers 67 recipes for the meals referred to in the works of famous Irish writers. instead of the usual literary pub crawl, this is a literary food crawl through the imaginations of the likes of James Joyce, Elizabeth Bowen, and Sean O'Casey. And crawl is the right word, because if you actually do eat some of the meals contained here, I'm wagering you'll be crawling on your hands and knees in the direction of what's known in Ireland as the bog. You'll know why Samuel Beckett had such a bleak worldview when you read the recipe for tuna omelette under his name. Short story writer Mary Lavin is partly to blame for the idea of making mackerel with prune stuffing. And the poems of Paddy Kavanaugh inspire a recipe for the traditional Saturday night fry, a kamikaze cholesterol fest of fried sausage, fried rashers, fried tomatoes, fried bread, and fried black and white pudding. Pass the pacemaker, please. At the other dietetic extreme, Irish vegetarians like George Bernard Shaw might have subsisted on a dish called champ, a mash of potatoes and leeks. The meat version is called thump. But by far, the most appalling recipe here is for something known as collared head, referred to in a novel by Oliver St. John Gogarty. It's a kind of massive sausage that requires 3 half pig's heads, 6 pig's feet, 6 hocks, a pair of boots, and an entire weekend to make. To be fair, a trifle, a coddle, a fry also includes tamer recipes for scones and soda bread, as well as a lot of delicious literary anecdotes. It also clarifies what's meant by the phrase, the luck of the Irish. Between famines and feasts like these, it's amazing we Irish have any stomach lining left. Happy St. Patrick's Day.
Maureen Corrigan teaches at Georgetown University. She reviewed A Trifle, A Coddle, A Fry. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Audie Voblaitis, Richard Parker, and Bob Alls. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Friday!
Or hit your arse on the way out. Fiddly diddly diddly dee. I was born to play the funky killy. Over the seas far away, on to America. Fiddly diddly diddly dee, where the wild, wild women are waiting for me. Think of me Friday whenever you see me. I'm a cushion, but how could I be without me? Honky, funky, Kaylee.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional grants are provided by the National Endowment for the Arts. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, making sense of Clinton's economic plan. We talk with Robert Krolwich, a CBS economics correspondent, former economics correspondent for NPR. And we talk with Richard Price about writing and producing the new movie Mad Dog and Glory, starring Robert De Niro and Bill Murray. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.